started this place strictly as a cover, but Professor Joe turns a tidy profit.
Please help us. Go to your phones. Bless your hearts.
Hello and welcome to Spoken Not Stirred, a James Bond podcast. My name is Harrison, and I'm joined, as always, with Daniel.
Good afternoon, Harrison. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. It's taken us a while to get another episode in, and but we got there in the end. We had a cracking last episode with our guest Dan on GoldenEye, and we've gone back a film. We're going in reverse order now. Well, we're not going to continue in reverse order, I doubt it, because I don't think you want to do Living Daylights next, but we're up to License to Kill. I'm going to unabashedly say it's one of my favourites.
Well, interesting. Well, we're going to talk about it. Let's see where we go. I'll give you, obviously, my feelings about the film. You've already expressed yours, which have been long-standing.
In terms of my experience of this film, when I first watched this, it was interesting because I obviously grew up with Pierce Brosnan as my Bond, and when I was curious to see what else was out there, I'd seen the Sean Connery films, I'd seen the Roger Moore films, or at least most of them, and I thought, who's this Guy Dalton? And I thought, this is really interesting, because these movies were not that old. When I was a kid, they were License to Kill was only 10-12 years old, and so when I watched it, it was a fairly fresh, modern almost action film, and it looked like the Brosnan era, but it wasn't Brosnan. But I think that growing up, though, this was considered to be among the worst Bond films. It was pretty universally, you know, it was not considered even a valid Bond film, I think, when I was growing up. It was very heavily criticised. And when I first watched it, I thought, yeah, this is okay. And then gradually it's steadily grown on me to the point where I could say, actually, this movie could easily be my top five now. I don't know. It's so different, though.
Yeah.
It's such a contrast to the rest of the franchise.
Well, I would say it's a contrast to much of a franchise before Daniel Craig. I think the Craig era is very much in this mould. And you know my feelings about the Craig era. I'm not a fan. And I grew up with Roger Moore, and therefore I saw this film indeed as part of that trajectory forward from the first film I saw, which was Spy Who Loved Me, in the cinemas. Clearly I knew, as I've discussed before, the earlier films, because they were shown on TV often and so forth. But in real time, you know, I went through from The Spy Who Loved Me onwards, and clearly The Living Daylights was the first Dalton one, which didn't grab me that well. This film was different. I did think it was a better film at the time, but I thought it was better than The Living Daylights anyway. But my feeling of it over the years has sort of, I've never really given it great consideration. However,
until
more recently, I watched it a couple of months back and I was extremely impressed. I watched it again and it's consolidated my view. I think it's an excellent film.
Yes,
and I think it is,
because when we first we actually watched it this film together about 3 months ago, let's say, and you were quite anti it at the time, or so I remember. It wasn't one of your worst, but it was.
I think my feeling at the time was, is it a Bond film? I think the issue was, is it a Bond film? Is it a good film? I said it was a strong film. Is it a Bond film? That was my issue. And I think it's a debatable point on all sorts of terms. We'll talk about it, obviously, in depth.
What has changed your... I mean, how did you consider this film previously? You still thought it was better than Living Daylights.
Yeah, but I never... Look, to be honest, it's not one of those films that you think, oh, Bond film, License to Kill.
You wouldn't tell anyone.
It's not... I'm sorry. I mean, the reality of it is... And look, it takes years before you come to a final position on a film anyway. Everyone will say the latest Bond film, it's the best. It's the best. They said it about Quantum of Solace, as they said it about every other Bond film. They will say it's the best film, whatever, or critics will say, well, so, and Bond films, it's great, brilliant. It's only in the passage of time, when you're looking at it, back at it, that you can actually come to any proper consideration of it. And I think this is a very strong film. In fact, it would be in my top 10. I would put it in the same category. I think it is a strong film in most of its parts. I think there are weaknesses of this film, which we'll discuss. But I would put it in the level of From Russia With Love, with the sort of type of film that this is. I think it's a very powerful film. I think it also, what it does is, this is moulded around Timothy Dalton. whereas The Living Daylights, as we know, was really written for Bond, not Dalton as such. And clearly, it's very much a leftover from the Roger Moore era, and it works awkwardly, I think, for
The Living Daylights is much more sits. It has all the hallmarks of a Bond film, or at least the Bond films of the Roger Moore era. Mm. What the producers were trying to do with License to Kill, and what Dalton was trying to do with his characterization of Bond, is he was trying to go back to Fleming and act as the Bond envisaged in the Fleming novels, like Live and Let Die. Mm. And you can really see that in his performance in this film. Like, there are various points where you're like, you're looking at him, this guy, and he's got this ruthlessness, this coldness, this harshness. And no other Bond actor before or even since has shown that level of coldness, as in the scene when he breaks into Milton Crest's yacht, and he goes and he puts the knife to Lupe Lamora, and he says, "Talk or you're dead." Like, say anything and you're dead, kind of thing. That's not the Bond that we were used to, certainly not from the Roger Moore times.
The strength of this film is it's moulded around Timothy Dalton. Timothy Dalton cannot play Roger Moore. He's not that sort of character. He hasn't got that same sort of charisma. What they have done and did successfully in this film is moulded a film around him which plays to his strengths. And it's clear to me, if he would have continued on, if they wouldn't have had that ridiculous legal dispute which basically botched up his continuation in the role, and it went on for 6 years, and he could have come back, but he obviously decided to give it a miss, which I think was a mistake. I think he should have done another film.
And I think the fact that he only did two films, and the fact that this was his second film, I think it's made for a complicated legacy for Dalton, because he went out on a film that was so different from the rest of the franchise. And okay, I guess if you look at the Craig films like Quantum of Solace in particular, that there are elements of that the revenge story, but to go out on this kind of film, I like to think that if Dalton had done a third film, it would have been a much more fantasy driven.
Well,
definitive Bond.
When you say fantasy, I would say more set out on a mission. This was not. Well, yeah. There's no mission here.
And the great thing about this, and why I say it's closer to Fleming, is we have to remember that in the Fleming novels, Bond didn't always go on what was considered to be a typical Bond mission. If we look at the novel Diamonds of Forever, he's involved in the mob. He's like, "What am I doing in some diamond smuggling mission? It's got nothing to do with Britain or anything." And then he also has a lot of these side missions in the story. In the short stories in particular, we're going to touch on one of those, which is called The Hildebrand Rarity, which actually has a character called Milton Crest who meets a grisly end. And actually there's the novel The Spy Who Loved Me, where Bond just stumbles in on this woman who's being held up by these gangsters in a motel. So Fleming did often put Bond in these situations that were outside of his universe. But when you watch this film, you think Bond's here for Felix Leiter's wedding, then he gets into this side mission against Sanchez, and then eventually he's going to move on and do whatever he was supposed to be doing. That's kind of the beauty of this film, that it's like an extra mission.
Well, I call this the equivalent of the George Lazenby type film. It's often said that A Majesty's Secret Service was a one-off film made, and really it was George Lazenby's film, and it was different from the other types of Bond films. You and I have had this discussion. You think it would never work with Sean Connery. I disagree. I think it would have been different, but it would have worked in this sense. But nonetheless, it was moulded around a different type of character, of which George Lazenby fitted. I think it's the same with this film. This film was clearly moulded around, our friend Timothy Dalton. There's no way Roger Moore could have done this type of film, or would have wanted to do a film like this. I don't even think Sean Connery would have played this type. It's very much plays to him, and as I say, it accentuates what he's good at, and lessons of things which he's not so good at. The charisma in it worked. I think the one-liners work very well here.
It's interesting because he does have a few one-liners, and the one-liners he has tends to be a little bit darker. They tend to be delivered like in kind of similar way to the way that Sean Connery delivered his one-liner in Dr. No, what happened? He's like, "I think they were on their way to a funeral." So it's got that dark humour. But actually, it's interesting because they gave a lot of the one-liners in this film unusually to the villain, to Sanchez. Sanchez has quite a few of the one-liners. And I think they almost realised that actually Dalton's strength... Dalton does not need to be Roger Moore. We're going to work around work to his strengths. But we can have the villain take on the one-liners in this film.
Well,
and that's what's great about Sanchez as a villain. There's so many layers to his character. And also, I don't think we've ever had a Bond film before or since that had the villain throughout. The only other examples maybe would be Live and Let Die, which, and I also see some similarities with that film.
Well, before we get to that, I mean, I'll take you on about the issue of the one-liners. I mean, what some of the strongest ones, dark it was, and there were some really gruesome parts of this film which we need to discuss, is the double agent, and that's Killifer, who actually obviously gets Sanchez free for money. And when then Bond confronts him, he meets his own grizzly end the same way of where he tried to doing Felix with the shark, and he throws him, and he's hanging on a thread, and he throws him the suitcase of money. He says, "You earned it, you keep it." You know, he goes in there. And then the other one, when he'd previously broken in, and he got caught by the guard, and he sees all the drugs in that car with all the maggots, and he throws them in his face, and he throws him in there. I think he says, "Bon appetit." And I think it's that.
That's right.
My point is, he does say them, and I think it carries it well. I think it works for him, and I think he's very convincing in this film. Mm-hmm. In this one, unlike in Living Daylights, which I saw in a cinema, and I remember watching it, and I was thinking to myself, I'm missing Roger Moore. This film, I feel this is Timothy Dalton. I didn't feel myself asking, "Oh, where is this? He'd be so better if it played." But I thought this is really good. He's playing this role. He's convincing in the role. It works for him. Mm-hmm. It's a darker type of film. Different type. It's still nonetheless very much Bond. I think you get a sense of Bond. I mean, M is in it. We know, and we're talking about M and money. Q has a big role in this film.
He's been given his biggest role. And actually, I think what the most interesting thing about this film is there are so many members of the cast, particularly the villains. Mm. And I don't think we've ever seen a Bond film where you have so many henchmen and villains, and they all have an element of character development. You have even these like side villains, like the last man standing actually is Professor Joe, who is the film's comic relief. He is the film's
bless your heart.
He's the film's Sergeant Pepper, but he's a really interesting. He's like what I would refer to as this film's sleazy but fun character.
He's a warm character.
Milton Crest would be the sleazy, yeah, but you know, you really don't like him character. And then you have Dario, you have Truman Lodge, Killifer.
Yeah,
it's so well developed, and you just see the scale of Sanchez as a villain.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got quite a lot in Heller as well as another Heller. One. Yeah, you've got quite a few.
But all of these villains have something different going on. Like, you have some that, like, you have the Milton Crest, he's a sleaze bag, but he's not like, he gets done for the thing he didn't do. Like, he didn't betray Sanchez.
No.
But that's the thing he gets done for.
Well, he gets done because Bond sets him up and basically goes around destroying these characters to be
a... Killifer is entirely self-interested.
Yeah, yeah.
Dario is the only villain that's a pure psychopath.
Mm.
And then Sanchez is, his villainry, it's very unique because he doesn't appear to be your traditional villain. And whatever he does is to exert his control and maintain his authority. And if he feels he's been betrayed, then he kills someone. What I never really quite understood is, why did he kill Felix Leiter in the way that he did? Because Felix Leiter didn't betray him.
Yeah.
He didn't kill Felix Leiter, but he killed Felix Leiter's wife.
Well, let's structure this, and let's get into the film. I mean, let's start with the beginning The beginning. I mean, I think it's a strong beginning. You know, it's Felix Leiter's getting married.
I like David Hedison. Yeah. But I would have to concede that there's no character development between him and Bond. Felix Leiter was in the last in the Living Daylights, and they didn't appear to be that close. And it was a very, you know, it's a different actor, obviously. They've brought back David Hedison, perhaps for a degree of familiarity from Live and Let Die. But where does this relationship come from? We're just made to assume that they've always had this relationship.
To be honest, I mean, my difficulty with him is David Hedison, I think, is a weak spot of this film. He's too old. He's 62, as opposed to 43, who was Timothy Dalton at this stage. I just didn't buy it. I thought he was miscast. I have to say that. I just didn't think he fitted in this film. His bride was much younger than him. I just didn't get the... I found it just was... What were they doing here? Why did they bring this guy back? You know, did they have a problem? I mean, no one had just said in previous films, critics saying, "Oh, Felix Leiter's been so bad in his guard."
The last Felix Leiter, I think, was probably the worst in the series. The one John Terry.
Yes,
he does nothing.
He is a bit bland. That's completely bland.
The best, I think, we could... I don't know if we would agree with this, but the best is Jack Lord.
Jack Lord,
and for a long time, I thought David Hedison was the best.
Yes, I think David Hedison in Live and Let Die was workable, but he fitted the age. It was sort of broadly...
He does put in a good performance in the shark scene, and that is probably the scene. the scene that I remember from this film. Well,
but this is a, so look, I have a problem already with him at the beginning and this affinity with Bond. But as we know, he gets dragged into this mission, this drug lord. They take it on and whatever. And that's the opening part of the film just before the wedding. But it's a good, strong opening, and they turn up in time for the wedding, and they manage to do what they need to do.
And that's quite an impressive stunt with the helicopter catch.
I think as an opener, it's a strong opening.
I really like the music. They originally had Eric Clapton down to do a rendition of the Bond theme, an instrumental. Mm. The titles were meant to be an instrumental, and they Clapton actually did a track with Vic Flick, the original guitarist from who done the Bond theme since the beginning, and that track is somewhere in the vaults. We will maybe one day we'll get to hear.
Why they never used it?
Look, the only other films which had instrumentals were On Her Majesty's Secret Service and Dr. No, of course. I think it would be pretty cool to hear that, but we've got License to Kill, Gladys Knight. I think it's a great song. It's not among the best, but I think it's got this nice 80s feel, and it's also got the Goldfinger feel.
Which was replicated again in the following film, GoldenEye, which we did with Tina Turner.
I think this is the better of the two, though.
I mean, look, I'm not a fan of Gladys or this sort of soulful music. I mean, look, it works. I mean, it's okay. What lets the opening sequence down, I think, are the titles, which are so dated. It's really naff. It's one of the worst ones, I think, of a Bond film.
No, I could take that. I don't think it's that bad. I just think the camera imagery is dated. I agree with you. It's not one of the best, but I don't think it's as bad as
that's to me one of the weak points of this film. But anyway, that's a sort of opening in setup and so on.
The music in general, though, what do you...
Yeah,
we interestingly have some 80s pop songs.
Yes, well, indeed,
Dirty
the end.
Dirty Love.
Yeah, at the end, of course, it's Patti LaBelle. Is it elsewhere? If you ask me to, is it? I think
if you ask me to.
I think it's quite a nice ending. I think it's quite a nice ending.
I really like the bar fight song, actually.
Yeah. There are some good tracks in there. And, of course, this was Michael Kamen, who was brought in to do this film.
And, of course, he's well known as being the composer from the Lethal Weapon and Die Hard.
Yeah. And look...
It has that Lethal Weapon feel to it.
Look, my feeling is it works with this film. It works with this type of film. I mean, he does bring in the Bond theme into moments in the film.
And if you listen to his, he's got a License Revoked suite on the soundtrack CD, and he uses it cut two or three instances throughout the film, and it's brilliant.
Yeah. Look, it's not my...
I don't think it always works, but...
Look, it's not my favourite of them, but I think it works with this film. Okay, much of the film, I mean, the whole body of the film is clearly the aftermath and the immediate aftermath of the wedding. What we see is he's escaped. He was helped by an agent who basically sold his soul to get him out for money. And then they come and seek their revenge, and they basically turn up at the home of Felix Leiter and his new wife. And that's the end of her, basically. And he is...
never really understood, though, why Sanchez... did this to Leiter, because he could have just got away. And if he hadn't done this, he would have got away scot-free.
Well, it's not quite understanding what... Yeah, it's not clear.
Well, did he really want to get rid of... I think he just wanted to send a message that DEA is to back off.
But why would he do... Yeah, as you say...
He was doing it to send a message.
But it seems to...
I think that Dario went beyond his briefing. Yeah. And they weren't supposed to kill Della. But Dario's...
Raped her as well, I think. And then killed... But then... So and then, effectively, we have Felix, rather gruesome scene with a shark, where they basically hang him with the shark and loses a leg in the process, you know. And this is gruesome for a Bond film. Bond films may have alluded to things in certain ways, but never crosses to this sort of level.
And this happens in Live and Let Die, the novel, but actually... We don't actually... read about Felix Leiter getting eaten by the shark. Bond just finds him, and then later on he confronts the robber character, and then puts him in the shark tank.
Yeah. So we have that sequence and so forth, and then Bond had already left the premises and was heading off to the airport on his way back home. Gets to check in and says, "What's going on? Oh, some major drug dealers escaped."
How did Bond not know until the final day?
Well, it seems a bit strange, doesn't it? In this way it is. And of course, all of a sudden he's just, "Hello, sir, where have you gone?" And he's
how does James Bond not know that happened until the next day?
It is strange. So effectively, then he goes off mission, and here he is finds Felix, you know, in his bag, and sees Della the lighter he picks up, which he was given. They gave it to him. He's got the gift. Okay.
Oh, and the Felix lighter is another little cute little thing, because if you go back to Live and Let Die, David Hedison's Felix lighter is communicating with Roger Moore's Bond through this like cab, or what is it, like the car that he's in. And Roger Moore says the line, a genuine Felix lighter. Yeah. And then all the way, fast forward 16 years, David Hedison again gives Bond a actual Felix lighter, which of course is the gadget that comes in use.
Of course it does. I mean, look, it sets it up. Clearly, Bond, having seen what's happened there, is absolutely outraged and clearly sets him up for where this film is going to take us, which is a revenge movie. And that sets the scene. And we now know what the mission, it's unofficial. It's a mission which is not an official mission. It's his own mission, which is to get Sanchez. That's his entire objective in this film. And that sets us up. So it's all very clear. It's all very set up. We know where we're going. We know who the characters are. And I think the characters, look, some are better developed than others. There's no doubt.
Sharky, I mean, they have the character of Sharky, and he just sort of, he's one of the few sacrificial lambs. He's a sacrificial lamb of the film, and he's killed off very quickly.
But I think he works all right. I mean, I mean, he's quite a good character in the role that he has in supporting Bond. I think
there probably are a couple superfluous characters that they could have got rid of.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's more. I mean,
just some that don't have enough to do, and parodying other things like the Truman Lodge character of Bud Fox, I think, from Wall Street. If that's,
I mean, look, there are certain things. So that, I think the setup for the film, the you know, where we're heading for, is well made. If you stick with it on that basis, I think we know what we're in for a ride. We know, given what's happened with Felix Leiter, this is not going to be a particularly nice type of film. It's not going to be your comfortable sort of put your feet up, enjoy. This is going to be on your edge, and there's going to be some nastiness in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the very type of movie this is. And indeed, I think this is, I don't know, some of the Craig movies might be rated 15. This was the first.
This was a 15 rating.
Usually they're PGs or.
I think this might be the only 15 rating.
Well, there we are, because it is quite brutal. It is brutal.
So he heads over to the warehouse and he confronts Killifer.
Now,
the whole build up to this is, and including the killing of Killifer, is actually, it's all ripped straight from Live and Let Die, the novel. Killifer is such an unlikable character. The way he betrays his, like, Felix Leiter is just so the two-facedness. But Killifer didn't want Felix Leiter to get put in the shark tank. You see, he's not, but as Bond says to him,
this is it. You take, you know, if you go down this path, this is where you're going to end up. And it wasn't pleasant for him.
And then obviously Bond gets confronted by M eventually, and we get this nice little meet up in Ernest Hemingway's house, and it's a very unusual. The role that M plays, I think it's probably the weakest appearance of M and Moneypenny.
Oh, well, we're talking
about Moneypenny in particular.
Well, we'll talk about her separately in a second. Let's talk about M and his performance. This is Robert Brown in his last performance. He didn't get many. He only got two.
He got four or five.
Hold on, let's work it out. It was this one.
He got Octopussy onwards.
And that was not many.
He did four.
Four, that's it. That's not many. He didn't get many. He's really
given nothing to do, and then they have this cut scene in London with M talking to Moneypenny, and that's it.
Later on, yeah, that's it. Well,
and she of course calls Q Branch, and then Q comes out. So this is Q's movie.
It is Q's movie. So look, clearly M's not happy, and his license has been revoked. The film was obviously going to be called License Revoked, but apparently they said the Americans wouldn't understand.
Well, License to Kill is a far better title.
But debatable. The issue is he lost his license to kill, so effectively, I'm not sure. I think License Revoked probably worked better with the context of the film.
Does Bond actually shoot anyone in this film? That's what I was trying to work out. Because he kills a lot of people die in this film, but does anyone actually get shot by Bond?
That's a great question.
Because, like, closest he came to shooting in my mind was like
he does. He fires the
spear gun. Compliments of Sharky.
Yeah. That's the only thing. I don't think he does fire his gun. Yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe it comes to us. I don't think he does.
He makes his way to the Wave Crest. I think we'll fast forward because it's,
We don't want a scene-by-scene film. But
I think what's great is when he then kills the guy and dives in the water and goes under. And this is classic Bond in terms of the underwater scenes. It's not too long. It's not going down the Thunderball trap. But you've got some brilliant underwater fight scenes. And then he makes his escape in typical Bond fashion. Wave surfing? Sea surfing? What's the term? You know, when you're skiing, water skiing, he water skis with no skis behind this plane and climbs on board. Yeah. And
it flows. The film does flow. I don't find myself getting bored in this film.
There's so much action.
There's a lot of action. There's a lot of, you know, we know, as I said, we know what type of film we're going to get in this one. It's rougher. It's nastier. The characters aren't pleasant. They actually are. I mean, whereas some of the characters in some of the Roger Moore, even some of the Sean Connery's, are almost sometimes a little bit comical in a sense. I mean, Goldfinger's a sort of semi-comical figure, even if he's a bit nasty. There's nothing comical against Sanchez in any way. He's a nasty bloke.
But he does have his nice little one.
And Milton Crest, another sort of
Milton
like...
Milton Crest, what's interesting is, like, there's Milton Crest is a character in a short story called The Hildebrand Rarity, where Bond is basically on Milton Crest's yacht, the Wave Crest, again there. And Milton Crest is a thoroughly unlikable guy. He has a fish tail, or what do we call it? It's a stingray tail. Mm. And you actually see that Sanchez has the same kind of stingray tail, and he uses it to whip Lupe. And so they've created this sort of compound. They've split out the character. And Milton Crest in the short story meets quite a grisly end. His wife or someone else on the boat stuffs a rare fish down his throat while he's sleeping, and he chokes on this fish in a really like gruesome fashion, and then Bond throws him overboard, covers up the crime.
Yeah, well, that obviously not in this film. But
Milton Crest in that book he's portrayed as being a drunk, a sleazy guy. And actually, Sanchez lectures Crest quite early on. He says, you know, I'll tell you something, loyalty is more important than money. You should learn that. And then later on, when he finds out when he believes that Milton Crest has betrayed him, then obviously that's the ultimate betrayal, because he said to Crest all along, don't get on the wrong side of me.
Yeah.
Don't betray me. Let's fast forward talking about Pam Bouvier, the main Bond girl of the film. Very, very unusual, very capable Bond girl, one of the best of the series. She stands, you know, she's pretty capable in terms of...
Well, I actually think both of them are very good in this film. I think they're both believable characters.
But there's a nice contrast between the
two. Yeah, they are different. They're very different in this way. And in fact, I get the sense that Bond can't make up his mind which one he really wants. I mean, that's the thing. Mm. And unfortunately, usually what happens in a Bond film, the secondary one gets killed, and that sort of solves the problem for him. But they didn't do that in this one. And I thought they made it quite uncomfortable and made it very difficult. It was basically too tiny.
And they end up fighting over him. I mean,
it's a really strange, and that's one of the problems I have with this, because they should have...
It's not until the very end of the film that Bond finally
makes his mind up.
Yeah. What's interesting about Carrie Lowell, Pam, is that she has her own thing going on. Mm. That she appears to be working for Bond, but really she has her own side mission going on, trying to negotiate with Hela. And the whole side plot about the Stinger missiles never fully developed.
No,
it's probably the weaker point of the film.
But I do like Carrie Lowell in this one. I think she is one of the best Bond girls.
Yeah.
I think it really works. They're believable. There's none of this.
She does quite a lot in this film. Mm. Like, I mean, she's piloting the plane. She's helping Bond out.
Yeah.
But also she's there like disarming Professor Joe. What was she doing actually by going in there?
I don't know.
Distracting Professor Joe.
Get the key. I don't know what she got the keys for. I didn't quite understand, because she didn't need to go in there in the first place.
What did she get the keys for?
I'm not sure.
She just went in there to get... because she wanted to go inside.
Yeah, into the... I think that's what it was. The weakness, or one of the weaknesses, which you touched on earlier, Caroline Bliss. What the blooming heck was... I mean, frankly, she was appalling in Living Daylight. She's just atrocious here. She has no real role at all.
It's not her fault. It's the...
She was poor in the Living Daylight.
I think they just wanted to have a side conversation with M just to kind of...
But she had no role with Bond, which is usually the interplay. Her role in this is tearful, as she was almost in it. I mean, it was frankly poor. I think the characterisation was really poor.
And they could have done another cut scene maybe where they actually had her speaking to Q or something.
Or not have her at all. I really think it was I really wouldn't have had her in a film at all. It does
serve as the way to explain how Q gets involved in this mission. Otherwise, it'd be completely unexplained. And
I agree with that. And clearly, as you've established earlier, as the allies, we said Sharky, he meets a grisly end, which is a typical way for a Bond ally to go.
You watch this and you're thinking, you see Q in the chauffeur hat and driving the Rolls or whatever car it is, and you're thinking, oh no, is he going to meet the same end as to Godfrey Tibbet? He's like, he's kind of playing a Godfrey Tibbet type character.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. He has more the most developed role in any Bond film for Desmond Llewelyn, and he plays it really well in this film. He gives a comic relief, which the film needs in light of its seriousness. And this is why I said earlier about the film, it's still believably Bond, because actually it's got some of the familiar themes. And Q in this film is so important to actually give it a bit of comic relief, particularly brings his gadgets over and Pamela Bouvier takes the camera, which he thinks is a camera. No, don't do that. Don't touch it. It's a laser gun. Which,
don't use the flash.
You know, in that manner. It doesn't play a role in any other. What does it play a role in later on? Does he play the camera?
I think part of the camera becomes the sniper rifle.
Yeah, that's right. That's the one with the... So there's a toothpaste, which is he uses to try and...
I think it's good, actually, sometimes when they have a gadget that's featured that's not actually used.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like... Then you're just thinking, every single gadget that's...
It's contrived. Nice to have a red... Yeah, you're right. Look, that works really well, of course.
What do you think of the Isthmus City, the casino hotel and the bank scene? I think it all establishes how much control, like what kind of villain is. And I think people have... The criticism that's pointed to this film is that Sanchez is not... He's not a Bond villain, he's a drug dealer. I think that's... He has all the hallmarks of a classic Bond villain.
Oh, I agree.
He runs by his own definition, an invisible empire that stretches from Chile up to Alaska. Yeah. And he also now wants to dominate Asia as well. Yep. So he's clearly a multinational, quasi-governmental style
Bond villain. I agree. Yeah, Sanchez is one of the strongest villains in the series, in the franchise, to be honest. He is very believable. He is nasty. He's more nasty than many others. But I think this guy really does fit the bill, and you can see why Bond wants him out and eliminated, and why the world would be a better place with him eliminated. So I think he is certainly a strength in this film. Now, you mentioned about the casino. You mentioned about...
I mentioned to you that there are elements of this section of the film, or this act of the film, whatever we want to call it, which reminded me of Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah.
Because the whole... backdrop is very like, you've got the gangsters, you've got this like Professor Joe character who's, I think he's this movie's Shady Tree.
Mm.
Because Shady Tree, of course, is a middleman, and so is Professor Joe. You even have, interestingly, the guy in the bank, this kind of very sleazy bank manager, Senor Montelongo, I think is his name. Mm. He's actually played by the same actor, who's a Mexican character actor called Claudio Brook, who was in films like Viva Maria, Kronos, and a lot of Luis Buñuel films, including Simon del Desierto. He's a very well-known actor. I just find it interesting, an interesting little nugget this bank manager was actually a famous actor.
Okay, so...
There's this kind of like when you see Sean Connery's Bond in Diamonds Forever, he looks out of place. Bond looks out of place here, and that's what's kind
of... The difference is, of course, but the tone of the film is so different.
You couldn't get more different.
No, this doesn't. However, what you've drawn attention to in this part, because Bond is in here and there's casino parts in this one, and this is, to me, another of my weaknesses with this film, and that is, he is probably the most drab, most unstylish Bond of all in this film. Who was responsible for wardrobe should have been shot. This is terrible. His wardrobe is so un...
His
hairstyle is ridiculous. He should have had it cut. I mean, he looks vampish, you know, in his hairstyle.
I don't know if that was intentional, that they wanted him to look a bit like Dracula.
But he looks ridiculous. And the suit, he doesn't look at home in the suit. He doesn't look like Bond. He looks like an off-the-shelf,
He looks okay at the start of the film.
His hair seems to be longer in this hair, and it's greased back. It looks appalling.
His hairstyle does change.
Yeah, it does.
And I think he actually looks good. I saw this on one of the... video debates, and he actually looks good in his pajamas. I was making the point that actually he only looks good when he wakes up in Sanchez's bed and just like he's wearing his pajamas.
His hair seems to be shorter at certain parts in the film than others. He looks terrible in this part, but some of the fashions he wears are really poor.
We also have to remember this was not a great time for fashion and not a great time for Bond
fashion. I don't accept that that's a justification, to be honest with you. I think this is just a really poor... He looks bad. Bond wears plimsolls in other parts of the film and stuff. He doesn't look like Bond, I'm sorry to say. That's one of the detractors from this film, in my view. And I think it, even in the casino parts, it doesn't really work. In fact, Carrie Lowell looks pretty stylish. She looks good in this film. And clearly, her hair was already cut. When, she was wearing a wig first part of the film, her hair was already short. And they then had the scene of cutting her hair in order to do it. And it was unusual, because Bond, to have it. And the only other short-haired Bondi was Halle Berry, I think, in Die Another Day. I can't think of another one who's got shortish hair like that.
I found the wig thing, the wig that she wears in the beginning to be interesting because I see her in some ways like this movie's Tiffany Case because, of course, Tiffany Case she keeps changing her hair as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just kept thinking, there's these little subtle things that could link into other Bond
films. Yeah, it is a one. But Carrie looks good. She looks stylish in this film. I think, as I say, I think throughout the film, she carries herself and I don't have major problems with her through this film. So we've got those. We've got the main villain, henchman. I mean, there's a number of henchmen here, and you could almost say that there are perhaps too many henchmen, and some of them are underdeveloped. Some of them we don't get a.
The only defense I'd say for having a lot of henchmen is to show the challenge of a lot of other Bond films is you never really see how well developed the villain's infrastructure is, and how you'd expect someone, a villain of this enormity, a drug lord like Sanchez, to have loads and loads of villains working for him. And that's that there are a lot of nameless henchmen that are never, they're never even named. I think it serves to illustrate the scale, but also I agree with you that maybe they could have condensed.
Well, I've got a number of them, but quite a few of them.
Could Truman Lodge not have been the same character as Hella?
Well, indeed. Hella, I didn't think, was particularly well developed.
And they're introduced quite late. They're introduced in the final act.
Well, they are. And also, they meet some gruesome endings. I mean, we mentioned about Milton Crest. I mean, his pretty much a nasty death in a decompression chamber. His face exploding.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty gory.
Milton Crest,
he's bad.
Which is brilliant.
It is brilliant, but it's still pretty gory in that sense. You then got the issue of Dario, which is was destined for Bond.
Brilliant.
I mean, that's a really nasty one in a machine cutting him up. And that is just, and hearing him screaming.
In a cocaine grinder and he's screaming.
It's horrible.
But Dario is such...
He's a nasty character.
He is the nastiest villain. And what's interesting is Benicio del Toro, the actor who played Dario, went on to become a very well-regarded actor in his own right. This was his first major film. This was his breakout role. Fantastic. He wasn't the youngest, though. I thought he was the youngest actor in this film. He's not.
Really?
Lupe Lamora.
Yeah, she was very young.
The actress is 2 months younger than Benicio del Toro.
She's 22.
They're both 22.
But that's quite a brutal, really nasty. I mean, it really makes you cringe in that way. And then Hella, of course, is impaled by the pickup truck. You just see him come through. I mean, it's quite, as I say, it's a vicious film. It's a nasty film. You get a sense that it's
course,
a brutal.
Sanchez's death.
And Sanchez towards the end, clearly.
That might be the least brutal of...
Well, it is the least brutal. It's a good ending to him.
He gets set on fire with his own cocaine-infused pet.
I mean, the truck scenes are very good, and the stunts in there are excellent. And it's a real good fight to the end. I wasn't so keen, as you know, in the last one with Alec Trevelyan being the main villain. I just didn't think it quite worked. With Sanchez, I think it really does work. I mean, Robert De Niro is only 36 in this movie. He's got one of those faces that looks older. He's got much more gravitas and believability to him, which I think it works against Timothy Dalton. He's a nasty piece of work. And indeed, well, at the end, as you mentioned earlier, the lighter comes back into it when he says to him, "Don't you wish to know?" And the lighter's inscribed with Felix and Della about to try and kill Bond with the knife. Then he sets him alight, and that's the end of Sanchez. Look, it's a great ending.
Does Sanchez actually read Felix and Della off the lighter?
Because
his eyes suddenly, there is a realization that this is more than just he sees this.
You're led to believe that he does. I mean, that's how. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense what he's done. Don't you want to know? Because otherwise, you would formally have to say it's because of what you did. So you don't get you have to believe that's the case in that sense. And look, I think it's a good ending to him in this way. Where, unfortunately, I think it ends on a bit of a dud, in my view.
The ending is a dud.
And the reason it's a dud is a dud.
You mean round Sanchez's swimming pool?
Well, exactly. And we have...
I think that this in reality was taking place quite a few days after the main action, because Dalton's Bond, all bloodied.
Yeah.
You know, like, and they're just suddenly in Sanchez's villa. Like, no, there must have been some.
No, well be the case. I don't doubt that's the issue. The difficulty I have is the conversation with Felix Leiter,
who's
is so ridiculous. Firstly, being told, he's got his job back, right? Well, why has he got his job
back?
Why
does Felix know?
Yeah, how would he know before he does, right? It's insubordination. How could he have not been faced? What's the justification for? Oh, it's all okay now. But secondly, Felix Leiter is all jumping for joy. He's had his wife was murdered. He's lost a leg.
Yeah, he's like smiling for me.
Hey, James, it's all good. I'm all great. James. I'll be out in a minute. I mean, what a ridiculous.
We're going to go fishing.
It's really, really ridiculous. And I think it's unnecessary.
I think there could have been an end scene in this film where Bond visits Felix Leiter in the hospital with flowers, or then they see them on
and you'll get out. But I think this is my point about David Hedson. I think he overplayed
this. He also, and I was shocked to hear this, and he wasn't the only one. Kerry Lowell also said that she showed up her first scenes and no idea what to do. She hadn't barely seen the script. He showed up and did his first scenes without only having read the script the night before because he didn't get them in advance.
Really?
So he admitted that the performance, when Bond comes into his study, it's a bit of a wooden... I always wonder why it's a little bit wooden. It's like...
Well, that's a bit bizarre.
The way that he introduces Pam to Bond.
Whatever is the case... you got to hold, John Glenn responsible for how he finished it on that way. About John Glenn, it's very interesting. He did 5 films in a row.
This was
the last one he did. The first one, I think, was For Your Eyes Only. And they couldn't be a contrast. I mean, how could this... It's hard to believe.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that he did this.
He did the same film as Octopussy or View to a Kill, you know, to License
to
Kill.
Oh, and that's what I was thinking the whole time watching this film. Is like... How different is this from what came just 4 short years before A View to a Kill?
It is so different. But it does show you that how you can, the same director can make a very different impact in that way.
Which is a contrast to if we measure him up alongside Sam Mendes, or probably the clearest example would be Lewis Gilbert.
Lewis Gilbert's films are all one trick pony. Yeah, he's the same.
Pretty similar.
This guy has shown variety. In a manner, and he's had different Bonds to play, 2 different Bonds to play with. But even with the same Bond, he's had a contrast. I mean, Living Daylights is a very different film from this one. And say, for A View to a Kill is very different from For Your Eyes Only in many ways. I mean, there are contrasts, but it's interesting. It's the same director in that way.
And the only movie that he really went on to direct after this and... Mm. I mean, he's primarily known for directing Bond films, but he directed a film called Columbus, Age of Discovery, and that... Timothy Dalton was meant to star in it, and he actually just said he wouldn't star in it if John Glenn was directing. So maybe they didn't get on, but it did star Robert Davi, Benicio del Toro.
Really?
I think one other actor from this film.
So look, I think there are certainly a number of strengths. I think this is a powerful film. I think it's a more grisly type of film. It's not the sort of film you want as entertainment with your popcorn. It's not that sort of Bond film. It's a very different type of Bond film.
It's a guilty pleasure of mine, but it's the opposite kind of guilty pleasure to when you reach for Octopus.
Yeah, yeah.
It is the guilty pleasure that you have when you want to watch a Lethal Weapon type film.
Yeah.
What do you think about this movie in terms of the Lethal Weapon...
It is in that mode. Oh, look, you know I'm critical of the Daniel Craig films being the Bourne legacy type films. Look, again, I think the difference I would put is he only did 2 films and they're both different in their way. And because he didn't do a third film, we don't really know how it was going to be taken. If they'd taken the same line with the next film, I would have been disappointed. I would have said, this is not what I want to see from a Bourne film. Mm-hmm. And we're always left on tenterhooks not knowing what type of film would have been the third film that he would have done.
Right.
And I would have hoped to have seen him be back more in a mission, a bit more back to... what we expect from Bond, but we don't know. So I think, yes, it's true, this might be in that sort of vein, but because it's different from The Living Daylights, we've seen a contrast, I think you can accept it in this way because we don't really know. With the Daniel Craig films, he's done 4, well, it's be 5 now, and they all seem to be of this revenge-orientated Bourne action movies, and I think there's this pattern there, which I don't think is... And that's my difficulty with them. I don't think they are... Bond films in the same way that I can call this a Bond film. Mm-hmm. And as I said to you, I think there are parts of it which are traditional.
The Bondian elements are there in terms of the stunts, in terms of the tanker sequence is fantastic. Yes. The plane sequence, they're there.
Mm.
But otherwise, a lot of it's more subtle.
Yeah. And there's another poor part I also want to mention, which I don't quite understand, the ninjas. What the heck was that about? Which didn't add anything particularly.
Was there in order for Sanchez to have an element of doubt that this guy, Bond, was actually trying to... He was involved in trying to foil these other guys who were trying to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that Bond then ends up at Sanchez's house. And we haven't spoken actually about Sanchez's house. It's fantastic. What a beautiful layer for the villain. Of course, he lives in a hotel. He has the hotel. His office is in the hotel. Yeah. But he's not restricted to that.
It's a very, very... Look, it's exotic.
And Bond wakes up there and it's like, last night.
Having said that, I don't think this is, for the reasons I say with the fashions and all that, I don't think this is a stylish film in that way. Although it's got elements of style, as you mentioned.
I think Dalton looks his best in this film, actually, when he's just coming down the steps.
Yes, I agree.
And Sanchez is there wearing the pink shirt, and Dalton's dressed in his sort of, he's wearing like the white shirt from his tux just open, and I think that's actually Dalton at his most casual, at his most best and comfortable in this film.
Yeah, no, I think that's true as well.
We haven't spoken about the climactic scene on the tanker chase, because that is a pretty extensive sequence.
It does take a bit of a while, and there were some good stunts. Explosions in that one, and traditional parts.
Isn't that Indiana Jones like?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, of course, where they're going to try and blast him away, and this is sort of the Roger Moore era. This element with where they set up the vehicle, and basically, and he turns the vehicle, it's a brilliant stunt in this one. And of course, it goes through and blows up the tanker behind, and the guy's running from
which is a real stunt. And actually, they originally just intended for it to miss, and they realized actually, why don't we put a tanker behind?
And I think that worked.
And then, well, of course, the second sting is used to, I don't know if he's trying to get Bond with it. He's probably trying to get the plane with it.
Look, I think that works well, and it's exciting, and it keeps your attention, and I think it flows. As I say, I find myself, you know, really into this. I think it's great.
You don't have a problem with the charge that this movie is too much like Lethal Weapon?
No, I don't.
And actually, when you see Bond at the end, he's all bloodied, and you know, Sanchez lifts him up with a machete and is about to cut it down on him. He looks like he's got this, like, it's Bond meets Bruce Willis, McClane, Martin Riggs.
Look, as I said, this is a film that I wouldn't, prior to this, have considered as a Bond movie. But it's over time, watching it and giving it more attention, I think this film grows on you, and it's far better in retrospect than what it was considered at the time. I think it's one of those films which actually earns its attention, apart from some of the weaknesses which we've drawn attention to. I think it's a strong movie. It's certainly a good one for Dalton to go out on. It's disappointing that he didn't get the opportunity again. But
I think there's an assumption that because he didn't do another Bond film, that it was because of this, which is
Well, it wasn't. I mean,
clearly wrong.
No, they wanted him back. They wanted it back for the next film, and he turned them down.
There was an assumption when I first saw this film, I thought, this movie was so bad it almost killed the franchise. But couldn't be further from the case.
No, it wasn't.
I mean,
it wasn't.
It wasn't particularly successful in America.
No, it wasn't. But I think that we were used to seeing Bond movies every 2 years, and this gap, which we didn't know if it was going to come back at all, really left us, you know, really it was a shame to go on this one, because really you needed another film 2 years after this one in a different mold to see.
Dalton didn't really go on to star in many major films. I mean, the next film that he was in, I think 91 or 92, was The Rocketeer. So I think
forgettable films.
If you feel lacking for a third Dalton performance, I'd say watch The Rocketeer, where he plays a villain. He starred in the miniseries, the sequel to Gone with the Wind, Scarlet,
but he's
was in Hot Fuzz as a villain.
Well, but also the thing I remember him on, he was in Doctor Who. He played Rassilon, the main villain in Doctor Who, in 2010, I think that was. David Tennant.
I watched last weekend actually this made for TV movie which is based on The Exorcist, or the original case of The Exorcist, and he plays one of the main fathers in that, and he's a good actor. Overall thoughts.
Yeah.
What would you rank this? I guess we've had a pretty healthy discussion.
Yeah. I think I would give it 4 out of 5.
Okay.
I think that's
right. That's really strong.
Look, the last film was the GoldenEye. I gave it 3. It's better than GoldenEye in my view. And I know we've done it in the reverse order. I don't think GoldenEye, people think rave about GoldenEye. I don't think it's a better film than this one. I really think it was a slightly retrograde type of approach. Could have worked, you know, as I said, if they would have toned down some of the darkness in the next film or whatever, they could have set them on a path to a believable Bond, and a Bond, as you say, a bit of fantasy into it, a bit more fantasy, not overdoing it, but I think it could have done. I think they went with GoldenEye down a path.
You can read the book Lost Adventures of James Bond by Mark Aylett, I think it's the name of the author, and he talks about the various plots of what would have been the third Dalton film, which some of which were regurgitated in Tomorrow Never Dies, but they had this idea that Bond would go to Hong Kong and come up against this machine robot. So it's pretty clear that they envisaged a lighter-hearted movie.
What do you rate it then?
I was thinking, you know, this is a solid 4. And then I was thinking, you know what, this might be among the best. So I'm going to give it 4.5.
Okay, well.
The only things that let this down is, as you say, that the ending is poor. I think it could have been a little bit tighter. I think there were too many characters. Mm. I just think 4.5 though puts it.
Yeah, it's in that
squarely. Like the last time I did rankings, I think this was 11th. Wow. Now it's for sure in the top 10, maybe 5th or 6th.
Well, I think it's probably in my top 10 as well. I think it probably
there are elements of this film that make it, you know, among the best Bond films, but there are some things that drag it
again down. I think you have to look at it at the strength of the character, but you have to look at it at its own strength. And I think
if you like action films from that period, from the 80s, then you'll like this, but you can't, it's not as good.
Yeah, but my point of it is, whereas I like this and can accept this film, the Craig movies are just don't. I can't.
I watch this movie almost like it's a Western, actually, and I think there is some basis for that, because it's like sort of Bond is, you know, no one wants to back him up, almost. He's having to go out there recruiting his own pilots, and he's almost like the lone sheriff. And even the other side, the DEA, aren't going with him. So I guess we should talk about what our next episode will be. And we've already decided it's going
to be...
Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die, it is. Yeah, wow. And
we will see the return of our guest, Dan.
Yes, yes. Live and Let Die, Roger Moore's first Bond film. And he was already... Well, I think he's 40-something.
46.
46, yeah.
46.
Okay, so there you are. Okay, so...
I think it's going to be a cracking episode. I think...
Well, they're all cracking episodes, but I think that one should be a good...
I think Skyfall was pretty poor.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, they're always good with you and me having our views and expressing...
Well, hopefully we'll get some difference of opinion on the next episode. Who knows?
You never know. You never know. We might get, about three of us, we might get some interesting disputes. Yeah. Okay. Look forward.
Cool. Daniel, thanks for joining me as always. This is Spoken Not Stirred, a James Bond podcast.